The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Did you turn the recorder on? Oh, thanks. And just explore what the present moment is, and why is it so important? It's something we talk about a lot, and so why do we emphasize this? And so I'd like to explore why it is important. Why is it so important, and what can we actually experience? What can we see in this split second of now? I think our orientation in our lives is very much to think about the past, think about the future, and feel like that's actually where the juice of our lives is. You know, that a lot of projecting into the future in terms of what am I going to do, who am I going to be, how am I going to get there, all of those kinds of planning, orientation towards the future. And that's where a lot of our life is lived, is in thoughts, not only about the future, but also about the past. How was I, what did I do, and how did I do it, and how's that going to help me go into the future? You know, we live so much in the past and the future. And when we actually begin to practice mindfulness and come into the present moment, we actually see that there's nothing but the present moment, that what we think of as past and what we think of as future are actually simply thoughts in the present moment. And so everything that happens to us, all of our plans, all of our recollections, all of our memories, it all happens to us now. This is all that there is this moment. It's it. Nothing else. Everything else is in our minds. So if we're not aware, mindful of this moment, we're actually missing our lives. So there's a poem that the Buddha offers about this. I'll read it to you, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. The poem is in the Majjhima Nikaya, those of you who like to keep track of these things. It is, yes, in fact. It does. Oh. Yeah, I think the last time I talked about it, I suggest that you memorized it. Yeah, in fact, it appears in four different suttas, and in three of them, there are people that are talking about the sutta and saying, "Do you remember that poem?" "No, I don't. The Buddha told us to memorize it." Or something along those lines. And so there's all these people who are trying to remember this poem, several instances of this. And so I think, maybe it's one to pay attention to since it appears so much. So I'll read it to you. "Let not a person revive the past or on the future build her hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let her see each presently arisen state. Let her know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is she, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night." So the first couple of lines of the poem are talking about this, reviving the past and pinning hopes on the future. So really, talking about this tendency that we all have to spend a lot of our time in the past and the future and not really coming into the present moment, meeting this very moment. Now, the poem doesn't actually mention what the sutta later, the first sutta in this series of four suttas that refers to this poem, mentions later in the text, that one can be vanquished by the present moment. Vanquished. I think it means conquered or something like that. the present moment, or the mind, we can be conquered by basically thoughts about the present moment, as we're conquered by thoughts about the past and the future. And so there's a distinction even in the present moment. You know, if we're just sitting here thinking about what we're doing and how we're doing it, we're again missing the actual lived experience of what's actually happening here and now. And so he goes into, you know, what is it that we actually need to do to meet this moment? And that's a lot of what I'm going to talk about today. But I'd like to share with you a modern-day commentary on this poem that I found in Peanuts, the cartoon Peanuts. Lucy, of course, the philosopher, is talking to Charlie Brown. And they're kind of, you know, hanging out, looks like they're hanging out, you know, sitting by the wall, arms on the wall, that scene. And Lucy says, "Do you realize how many great moments in life are wasted? Take, for instance, the great moment that's coming up right now. Bang, it's gone. You've just wasted it." And Charlie Brown says, "You're a lot of fun to be around." There's a lot of truth to this. Bang, it's gone, you've just wasted it. You know, that if we don't actually meet the present moment, we're missing our lives. So I want to talk about the present moment from a couple of different angles, about what happens. I mean, a lot of what happens to us is this thinking about past and future. So I kind of want to start there a little bit. There can be a way that we think about past and future that is kind of neutral, you know, just remembering. Memories come up. But often the memories, they don't stop there. Or, you know, thoughts come up like, oh, yes, I've got this plan with this person tomorrow. So, you know, we can just think about the past and the future. The reviving that is mentioned in this poem, of the past and pinning hopes on the future, is more than that. It says that, you know, in the commentary of the poem, it says that thoughts will arise about the past, or thoughts will arise about the future, and the term that's used in there, I take a slight issue with, because I'll tell you what he says. He says one delights in that. A thought appears about the past and one delights in that, and that's how one revives the past. Or a thought appears about the future and one delights in that, and that's how one pins one's hope on the future. And you know, this is an interesting thing that I've seen in other places in the suttas, that the Buddha often talks about the delighting in sense pleasure and the you know, the delighting in memory and you know, the wanting pleasant sensation. He mentions that a lot, and it certainly happens to us. But I find, at least in my own experience, that an equal portion of my reviving the past has to do with beating myself up over what I did, or trying to figure out how to change the past because it was so horrible that I didn't like it. And I mean, the Buddha came out of a very lovely environment. You know, he came out of a life of pleasure in the palace and, you know, lovely childhood, well taken care of, you know.
It was lovely. I was told his mother died when he was 7.
She died at childbirth. He was raised by his aunt. Well, the myth is that he had absolutely no unpleasant experience. And he talks about it. He talks about his life as being delightful before he went out into being a monastic. And so I think that, you know, that's his orientation. My orientation is quite different. And so I think there's an equal part of reviving the past that has to do with how we are averse to it and pinning hopes on the future an equal part as to how we are averse to what we're projecting and thinking about. Don't want to go there. Got to figure out something better than that. And so it's kind of it's an aversive movement. And so the craving of the reactivity that we have includes both wanting to have things that we like and wanting to get rid of things that we don't like. I mean, that's clear in the texts as a whole. But there are little places I see where it's like the Buddha just slips into this habit of his own of, you know, reviving the past is delighting in thoughts about the past, whereas there's a lot of thoughts, and I know others have, that are not so delightful. But the key is that we don't just let the thought arise and pass away. We let the thought arise and we give it life. We enter into the world of that thought. It's like, you know, the cartoon bubbles, you know. I remember at one point I was walking down the street, and I had broken up with this guy several years before and had entered into this world of thinking about being with him. You know, memories of things we had done together. And by this point, I had worked through the pain enough that the memories were pretty neutral. You know, that they didn't cause me a lot of grief or anxiety. And so the memories came up, and I was in that world. And then at some point, something happened, and it's like, poop, the bubble popped, and I'm out, and I'm walking with this friend. And it's like, there was this incredible confusion that happened. I think often what would happen normally to us at that point would be, you know, a reaction to that thought world. You know, that in certainly before I had worked through all of the pain of the breakup, I would have been experiencing pain. It's like, oh, that's not my life anymore, and oh, he broke up with me, and oh, what a jerk he was, and I would have been off. But because I had worked through all of that and there wasn't any reactivity, when I came back, there was just this like, whoa, I was just in this world where I believed that relationship still existed. You know, the bubble popped it was like, wow, where am I? And am I in that relationship or not? Because I saw in that moment when the bubble popped that I had completely entered into that world through thought. I was out of the present moment and living in my thoughts. That's reviving the past. Whether it's neutral, whether it's producing anxiety or producing delight, that kind of movement of the mind into a construction of either past or future, we can do it on both sides. So the key here, actually, is that construction happens in the present moment. That construction of that world is a phenomenon that's happening in the present moment. Now, when we're absorbed into it, we don't see it as the present moment. You know, we're living in that world, and it's kind of like we're disconnected from what's actually happening in the present moment. But in that moment where we come out of it, we can see what's actually happening now. And we can see that thought world, that reviving the past or pinning hopes on the future, that's a construction of the present moment. And not only, I mean, so the thoughts can happen. The thoughts come and go. I could have had a thought about that ex-boyfriend appear and disappear. If I'd been more continuously mindful walking down the street, I might have seen, oh, there's a thought about my ex-boyfriend. There's a thought about him. And there's the all of the scattered sweet amber balls on the sidewalk, you know. And there's all of that, you know. So there would have been the next moment of actually seeing what's actually here in the present moment. But so that we can see that thoughts are simply arisings in the present moment. That is the truth of the thought in the present moment, that it is an arising event. It's not that it's a problem. It's not that we have to stop thoughts. It's not that we have to say thoughts are bad. But it's helpful to see that what thoughts are is simply an event occurring in our minds in the present moment. We give so much weight to thought. And that kind of building on the thought with more thoughts is what gives it weight and gives it kind of a sense of, yes, that's really the way it is. So there's that whole process that is something that's so much how we live our lives. So it's really worth getting to know that process. And then not only that, you know, not only do we think about things and kind of create these worlds, we also react to those worlds. And we create the memory of the past and react to it. We create a thought about the future and we react to it. Now that reaction can be either an aversive reaction, which tends to lead towards, you know, difficult emotions of anger, hostility, frustration, irritation, annoyance, anxiety, worry. On the other side, the greedy side, it can lead to thoughts of excitement, lust, planning, all kinds of other pride. Vanity, those kinds of things on the lust side can pull us into reactivity. I'm calling both sides reactivity. So, you know, how does this happen to us? Reactivity is, I mean, we think, what I think we get fooled about is that you know, when we, especially about the past is really seductive in a way because we remember things. And I'm not saying that things didn't happen to us. I'm not saying that it's false in the way that it didn't happen to us. But it is a memory that's happening now that we're reacting to. And that's the key. That's one of the key pieces to notice. What we think we're doing is reacting. We've projected ourselves back in time, you know, in our minds, this thought bubble that I talked about. We've projected ourselves into that world, which we think is back in time. And we think we're reacting to what happened then. So, you know, some event, a friend has said something to you that hurt your feelings. You know, you call that memory comes up in your mind. And in the thought bubble that we've created, in that revived past, we're reacting to what we think we're reacting to what was actually done then. But if you actually look in your experience, what's happening is that you're kind of going along, you know, things are kind of, you're walking down the street or you're in your kitchen preparing a meal or you're talking, typing on the computer or, you know, doing something kind of neutral and things are fine. And then something triggers a memory. Something triggers that memory. Often something in our physical world. You know, maybe a sight of a Starbucks that you were talking to your friend in or maybe a vegetable that you're preparing in your meal reminds you that you had used that vegetable with this person or something, you know, something like that. So there's this memory comes up. Before that memory came up, there wasn't any particular reactivity about that person. You know, it wasn't there. The memory comes up. And in that moment, the memory comes up, the mind creates that world, and then reacts to that world. So all of our reactivity is created in the present moment to things that are happening to us in the present moment. They may be reflective of things that happened in the past or reflective of things that we're hoping to happen in the future. But our suffering, our our reactivity, the pain that we experience through our reactivity, is being constructed right now. I'm going to say this again. It's constructed based on things that are happening right now. Thoughts in the mind. I mean, that's a lot of where our suffering comes from, is reactivity to our own thoughts. And when we begin to see this with clarity in our mindfulness practice, it's a huge eye-opening experience, because we begin to see that so much of what we're doing and how we're responding to it is simply our minds. Now, a lot of this happens in our regular lives before we really meet mindfulness, or at times in our lives where we're engaged in work and our mindfulness isn't quite so present. A lot of this happens below what we might call the level of conscious experience. You know, that this memory pops up and the reaction almost happens before we are consciously aware of it. And this is where the training in meeting the present moment becomes so powerful. Because in my own experience, all of that reactivity that seems to happen below conscious awareness, what we think of as in the subconscious realm, all of that can become visible to us. In my own experience, that kind of line that divides what we're consciously aware of and what we're not consciously aware of, you know, the unconscious of Freud or the subconscious of Freud and what we're consciously aware of, that line is not a hard line. It is a very permeable line that can be, we can sink into it through our mindful attention. And I actually think that there's probably not much that we can't see, that the power of mindfulness is quite strong. It's quite amazing to be able to see, you know, when the mindfulness gets continuous, when the mindfulness is happening moment to moment, the mindfulness can see kind of an unfolding chain of events. It's just like physical sensation appears, thought appears related to that physical sensation, belief appears in that thought, reaction appears to that belief, and this unfolds in a split second. But the mind can actually see it. The mindfulness can see this. It's not something you can try to do. It's kind of, the mind has this capacity to see things this rapidly. And what we can do is to begin to cultivate the mindfulness, which begins to reveal how our minds work. So that kind of reactivity to thoughts is a huge part of how and why we suffer. So suffering, our reactivity, happens in the present moment. And it's happening to things. It's happening about things that are also happening in the present moment. And so the mindfulness can really begin to open up this, to see this process. Now, the great thing about mindfulness, I mean, there wouldn't be much benefit in mindfulness if, you know, you could open up and see this and it didn't make a difference to see it. You know, if you just got to see, this is how your mind drags you around. This is it wouldn't make much difference. But there's this great thing about mindfulness, and I think also about the way we're built, about our whole biology, about the whole system that's put together here as a human being, that the system kind of wants to head towards well-being. The system as a whole, the entire physical, mental system wants to head towards kind of a sense of well-being, a sense of happiness. And, you know, I think it comes, and I'm reading a book right now by a neuroscientist who does a lot of work on exploring how consciousness comes to be. And he's exploring it from the evolutionary perspective. So he's looking at, you know, how do single-celled creatures without a nervous system behave, and what kind of modeling is there that we can learn as creatures become more and more complex. And even single-celled amoebas have this kind of sense of what well-being is for itself as a creature. You know, it moves into an environment that's got noxious chemicals, it moves away. You know, it wants to move away from harm and suffering and towards things that are beneficial towards its survival. Very simple. Our whole system is put together for this with this kind of pattern that we want to move towards survival is kind of number one, but you know the system is designed to feel good when things are working well. And what mindfulness starts to do, you know, when we begin to come into the present moment and see moment by moment how the mind is constructing our reactivity. When we see that, when the mind sees what it's doing, it sees, oh, and this is, I'm putting a kind of a, you know, a word or a, you know, a beingness into this process. It's just what happens. It's the mind realizes it's creating its own suffering, and it starts to let go of it because of this kind of, you know, movement, this kind of natural, organic movement towards well-being. When the mind understands through seeing what is happening, what it's doing, it begins to see that it doesn't need to react to a construction of the past. It's a kind of a very natural phenomenon. As long as that level of the subconscious is not seen, we'll be operating at a level where we're more at the sense of, you know, the sense of what well-being is has a different understanding to our conscious minds. You know, well-being means I need to get what I want. But as we begin to explore moment to moment, the sense of well-being has a much finer definition to our system. And the mindfulness is it's the guide. If we are mindful of our present moment experience, it will lead us towards well-being. And that's the great thing about mindfulness and the great thing about mindfulness of the present moment. It actually leads us kind of step by step to happiness. So I've talked a lot about this reactivity to thoughts and past and future. We also react to the present moment. We react to things that are happening in the present moment. A lot of this has to do with kind of physical senses coming in. You know, pleasant, unpleasant experience, physical sense experience. We cut ourselves with a knife, there's unpleasant sensation. You know, it's just a very natural thing that the body produces pain when it's damaged. And it's a very natural thing for the body to feel pleasure when it's gotten, enough food to eat. You know, so there's just this kind of natural, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral quality to our physical world. And we react to that. I mean, we react to things that are pleasant. We want more of them. We try to arrange our lives to get more of them. Things unpleasant, we want to get rid of them, try to arrange our lives to not have any of those. And so this pleasant, unpleasant experience in our physical realm also produces a reactivity. And that's another place where this reactivity is born. And again, the pleasant and unpleasant experience is a kind of a guide in a way for us. You know, when the body feels pain because it's hungry, it's a guide that, you know, it's time to eat. Or if it feels pain because we've cut it with a knife, you know, it's a guide. We need to do something about it. But we don't simply often, you know, just leave it as a guide like that. You know, it's like, oh, I cut myself with a knife. Oh, guess I better go to the hospital and get some stitches. You know, it's more along the lines, oh, how am I going to be so stupid? And what am I going to do now? I mean, I don't have time for this. I'm getting ready to go teach a class. You know, I got to find somebody to take the class. You know, so the mind just, that part isn't so necessary. And that's reactivity. That's the suffering aspect of it. So again, beginning to see, can we see where the line is between the sensation of pleasant or unpleasant and the mind kind of projecting off of it? And this is part of what I'll talk about in this series, that this body and mind series that I'm talking about. I'm going to be starting this Thursday. So I've talked a lot at more length than I expected about that piece of it. So what I think I'll do is I'll talk about one other piece of the present moment and then just open it up for some questions. So another powerful piece around the present moment. I mean, what I've been talking about so far is pretty much, can we meet the present moment? Can we meet what's happening? You know, that things have happened to bring us to this moment. And some of those things that have happened to bring us to this moment include thoughts. They include all of the experiences we've had. And here we are in this moment experiencing this thing here and now. And to be able to meet what is actually happening here and now, be able to meet things as they are, is very powerful. Often that teaching about meeting things as they are is kind of misunderstood in a way to be interpreted that it means that when we meet things as they are, we just kind of sit back and let things happen to us, that we don't take any action. That's kind of the instruction in meditation. You know, let things arise. Don't try to follow on thoughts. You know, come back to the present moment. You know, if a thought's encouraging you to get up from meditation and go clean the refrigerator, you just, you know, hang out and watch the thought come and go. But in our daily lives, in our daily movement, you know, we can't just be lumps on a log. We need to make decisions. We need to make choices. We need to take action. And the present moment is the place where choice occurs. That is where we choose how we're going to meet the next moment, how we're going to step into the future. So it's very powerful not only to just meet. Do you need a signature?
No.
Okay, thanks. It's very powerful to be able to just meet the present moment as it is. But the real power of it does come from the choices that we make in this moment about how we meet this moment and how we choose to move into the next moment. So this is about choice. This is about intention and motivation. This is the decisions we make moment to moment are what shape our lives. And again, this is a large part of what lies below what we normally think of as what's conscious for us. Every single split second, there are decisions being made. For the last 30 seconds, there have been decisions that you've made about whether to keep sitting here or whether to get up. There have been decisions made about whether to move your body, to shift around. There have been decisions made about whether to swallow, blink your eyes. All of that stuff is actually, there's some conscious, there's some decision-making happening around it. Now, it doesn't have to be in the conscious realm for those things to happen. So the kind of power here around this teaching is that if we are not conscious and aware in the present moment of these decisions, it's our habits and patterns that make our decisions for us. It's our kind of historical kind of... we've all got this kind of direction that we're headed based on the choices that we've made in the past, based on how we've lived our lives in the past. There's kind of this direction that we're heading. And if we don't, if we're not aware in the moment of what's happening, that directionality is what's going to choose for us. You know, if we have spent a lot of time in our past making choices based on what we don't like and want to get rid of, that's probably the unconscious decision-making pattern that's going to kind of operate if we're not aware. And so another powerful reason to actually be in the present moment and be mindful is so that we can consciously make decisions, so that we can be aware of how we're reacting and see actually that there's choice, that we have choice actually moment to moment. We have a vast amount of choice that we're not really aware of. So making those choices, if we can make skillful choices, if we can choose to act out of compassion, out of generosity, out of kindness, out of wisdom, then we are heading ourselves in that direction of well-being. If our actions are motivated out of aversion, out of greed, out of delusion, we're heading ourselves back into the cycle of reactivity, of struggle, of suffering, of dissatisfaction, of just trying to fix things, endlessly trying to fix things and change things and manipulate things. So seeing in the present moment not only what has come to be based on everything that has happened in our past, but also seeing that there's the choice of how we move forward. I saw this is the last piece I'll say before I open up to questions and thoughts. I just recently saw the documentary called Dhamma Brothers, which is a documentary about a prison project, and the this was the first time people went into a prison and did a 10-day retreat with some of the prisoners. So this wasn't just going in and offering a weekly meditation class to the prisoners. This was creating a way that they could actually hold a meditation retreat inside the prison. It was quite phenomenal, actually. You know, they took one of the gyms and locked down the gym. Some of the guards were in there with them. The teachers were living in a room upstairs that got locked at night. So they were locked in at night. The prisoners were in this gym, and they'd kind of created this area where they could have the meditation hall, and then they had this other area where they were all sleeping. They were sleeping on mats on the floor, and they had these sheets between these little cubby holes. So they were all pretty much in a dorm situation. And they instructed them in the practice of mindfulness meditation. What they talked about as being the powerful impact, you know, when they finished the retreat and were talking about it afterwards, even 4 years later, when they were talking about it afterwards, the main impact that they talked about was seeing that they had a choice in the present moment about how to react. That was the power of their, and it was huge for them. I mean, in a prison situation, there is so much suffering and so much danger to people that seeing how you react to that danger, to somebody coming up and maybe shoving you in the cafeteria or something, or seeing how you react when somebody comes at you and says something really kind of nasty, those verbal daggers, seeing that there's that kind of, and taking a breath and just choosing to not immediately come back with something or come back with a physical reaction. That, over and over again, that's what they said was the power of their retreat. And how much peace and happiness and sense of lightness they had because of that. So I found it very inspiring to hear. I was, you know, hearing that they did a 10-day retreat. I was curious how they did it in a prison. You know, how did they manage to do that? And I was also a little skeptical in a way that it would have a lasting impact. You know, that because I see on retreats that we do here, you know, we do these retreats here, 10-day retreats, and people have very profound experience and then come back into their lives, and it seems to last for some period of time that there's a connection to that experience. But often it seems that it dissipates over time, that kind of juiciness of that connection to those realizations. But what was striking to me was that that didn't seem to happen in the prison. And I thought about why that might be. And what I came up with, and I don't know that this is the case, but what I came up with is that when they left their retreat, they weren't going back into an environment that was more comfortable. They were going into an environment that was more dangerous. And so they, day by day, found that using the skills they'd learned in that 10 days dramatically help them navigate that very dangerous environment. Whereas when we come back from a retreat, we're coming back to our nice homes, our comfortable beds, our full refrigerators, our friends and our music and our cars, and it has a real seductive pull to it. So that this practice can be extremely powerful if we let it, and if we, you know, keep coming back into the present moment, allowing that mindfulness to be our guide through our experience. So, wow, I talked way more than I thought I would. We've got about 6 minutes. Are there any comments? Or yeah, Larry. Oh, why don't you use the mic?
What about the dream world?
So say a little more.
Vivid dreams, nightmares.
So the way in the practice that we're doing here, the kind of way of working with that would be in the moment of waking up from that nightmare or vivid dream, just like waking up from that thought world that I described, what is happening here and now? Now, when we have these thought worlds, a dream could be considered a thought world, we wake up from that, it has had an impact on us now. So paying attention to how has that impacted you now. You know, if you've had a nightmare, you may wake up with a pounding heart, with images still in your mind, you know, feeling the kind of anxiety and terror of that a nightmare. And the instructions would be, bring attention to that experience. Don't linger back in the past of the nightmare, but take in what's actually happening here and now. Likewise with vivid dreams, and same kind of basic instruction. Although, I've seen myself how interesting it is to kind of take an element of a vivid dream, especially ones that are really vivid, you know, take an element of that and kind of allow that to come up into consciousness and see what happens as that comes up into consciousness. But I think that this is basically a reflection, a reflective practice. And there are reflective practices taught in this tradition, and they're you know, you bring something up in your meditative experience, and then you let go of it in favor of, okay, what's happening now? You don't keep ruminating about it, but notice, you know, it's like dropping a little pebble into a pond. You know, what are the ripples of that experience? And so bringing up an aspect of a vivid dream into consciousness, what are the ripples of that? Did it make you feel delightful? Does it make you feel powerful? Does it make you feel anxious? You know, what is the response here and now? And that's where we get our information. So those are some thoughts about that. I mean, there's clearly a whole different realms of teachings around working with dreams, and I think they're very valid and can lead to a lot of understanding, but I'm just talking about what, you know, what does this tradition have to say about it? Any
book.
Which book?
The one
on the movie. Oh, the Dhamma Brothers. So she was just talking about reading the book about the Dhamma Brothers and how it was a kind of a life changing. Yeah, I understand that it was written by the woman who made the film, and you know she actually brought in quite a lot more detail about what actually happened. Mm-hmm. Their commitment.
By their commitment and their transformation.
Yeah, I mean that.
Deeply moving, deeply inspiring.
It is very inspiring, and the other piece that I found also inspiring was that you know at some point the prison told them they could not meet as a group to meditate together. They cut that off because this was a prison in Alabama, in the Deep South, in the Bible Belt, and there was some threatened sense of. You know, feeling like the whole prison was going to be converted to Buddhism. And so they shut down the meditation group. But they were trying to find places on their own, you know, to meditate. And they kind of had surreptitious little groups that met together. And so they found ways to keep their practice going. But then 4 years later, they allowed they allowed it back. There was some shift in the prison leadership, and they brought them back in to do a second retreat. And that was where they were really talking about, you know, there was this meeting of the new people, the new retreatants, and the people who had done it before. And the people who had done it, who were new, were like, well, what did you experience? What did you find helpful? Why is this going to help me? And this is where they were talking about how they could see their reactivity and how much it had helped them. And you know, they were all ready to come back and do it again, you know, so happy that they had this other opportunity to engage in this. So did you have something, Mary? Okay. So it's 11, so we need to stop now. And thank you for your attention.